Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Em.
And I'm Kaz. And in today's episode, we're going to focus on a very well-known biblical character. He's powerful, heroic, and beloved by many Bible readers, despite the various shenanigans he gets up to. So, can you guess who I'm talking about?
Well, I can think of quite a few biblical men who get up to lots of shenanigans, but from what you've said about a powerful and heroic biblical figure, I'm going to guess that you're talking about David.
Yes, you are correct.
Yes.
David. David, the shepherd boy who bravely killed the Philistine giant Goliath. David, the Lord's anointed, chosen by God to be founder of a royal dynasty. He's a fearless warrior who successfully protected Israel from its enemies. He's a talented poet and musician, credited with writing dozens of psalms. And, according to the genealogy at the start of Matthew's Gospel, he's a direct ancestor of Jesus Christ. So, all in all, he plays a really significant role in the Hebrew Bible, and his legacy lives on in the Christian New Testament too.
I can sense a but coming, Kaz.
Yeah, well, David may be a biblical hero, but he's by no means perfect.
And there it is.
Throughout his reign as king over Israel, he does get involved in several situations that cast a shadow over his character, particularly in terms of his moral integrity and his treatment of women.
So how are we going to tackle David, Kaz?
Well, I thought we'd take a closer look at one particular episode in David's life and think about the way that he uses his masculine power, privilege, and entitlement to enact some really terrible violence. And along the way, I'll get you to think about some more recent examples of men who've likewise used their power, privilege, and entitlement in very dangerous ways.
Cool.
So, just a heads up to our listeners, we will be talking about sexual violence and serial sexual abuse during this episode. So if you find these topics particularly triggering, please take care as you listen. And as always, we'll leave a list of support services in our show notes.
Now, we spoke about dangerously powerful men in an episode from the last series of The Bloody Bible, and I remember you said something really interesting about masculinity and power. Can you remind us about that, Kaz?
Sure. So if I recall, I said that masculinity and power are like two unstable chemical elements. If you mix them in just the right amounts, you can create something really special. Powerful men can be the heroes in our community. But if you mix these elements in the wrong way, or you have an imbalance between the elements, then you're more likely to end up with something dangerous and toxic, such as men who feel entitled to use their power and privilege to serve their own interests, and often at the expense of vulnerable women and men who are far less powerful than them.
Thanks. That's a really helpful reminder. And if any of our listeners haven't listened to that episode in Series 1, it's entitled Power and Privilege, Dangerous Biblical Men. It's really excellent and I recommend you check it out. But of course, I am a little bit biased.
Yeah. No, it is excellent. It is.
So Kaz, what part of David's story are we going to focus on today?
I thought we'd look at David's encounter with Bathsheba and his eventual murder of her husband, Uriah, which we read about in 2 Samuel 11.
Yes, I know this story. Sounds good.
And throughout our discussion, I'm going to draw on the work of Professor Barbara Theed, particularly her book titled Rape Culture in the House of David, A Company of Men. It is such a good book, and it made me look at the David traditions in a completely new light.
Yeah, I agree. Barbara's analysis is just brilliant.
Yeah, it is. So, 2 Samuel 11 begins with David first catching sight of Bathsheba. Now, to start us off, can you remember from your Sunday school lessons what actually happens in this scene?
So, as far as I remember, David is in his palace and he sees Bathsheba having a bath on her roof.
Okay, that's what I used to think too. She's on the roof, bathing in full view of the palace. David can't help but see her. That's how the story is often told.
And that's also very prevalent in artists' depictions of this scene as well, right? Bathsheba is always outside, she's usually naked, having a bath in full view of everyone, while David kind of lurks in the background.
Yeah, so Can you read out verses 1 to 2 so we can see what the text actually says?
Sure. So it reads, "In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful." So hang on, wait, what? He's on the roof, not Bathsheba?
Yeah, exactly. The text doesn't clarify where she was bathing. Technically, she could have been indoors and David spied her through a window. Or she could have been on the roof of her house. Barbara Theod points out that in ancient Israel, people may have regularly bathed on the roof because that's where the rainwater was collected in cisterns.
Okay, that makes sense.
But Barbara Theod also makes another important observation. According to biblical texts and archaeological evidence, ancient Israelite houses typically had walls around the edge of the rooftop. So even if Bathsheba was bathing on her roof, she may well have assumed that she was sheltered from view by the walls surrounding her. She wouldn't have imagined that anyone, not least the king, would have been spying on her from the palace rooftop.
Have you ever seen the film David and Bathsheba, Kaz?
Oh, is that the one starring Gregory Peck as David?
Yeah, it came out in 1951. And in this one scene, Bathsheba, played by Susan Hayward, admits to David that she was deliberately bathing in his line of vision because she wanted to catch his attention.
That's so interesting because I've also heard something similar in biblical interpretations of this text. Some biblical scholars argue that Bathsheba didn't take enough care to avoid being seen by David, or that she deliberately chose to bathe where he would see her. According to one scholar, who I shall not name and shame, Bathsheba showed a, quote, "reckless, almost salacious carelessness. It is unbecoming to a woman to take a bath when men are there to see."
Okay. I'll remember that in the future.
Yes, you really should, Em. Another interpreter suggests that Bathsheba is, at best, terribly naive, and at worst, calculating and clever.
Huh. Calculating in what way?
The suggestion is that she was being deliberately flirtatious and provocative because she wanted to catch the king's eye and begin an affair with him.
These interpretations are so annoying, though, because they're reading something into the text that simply isn't there. Bathsheba was bathing in her own home. It's not her fault that her house was in full view of the royal palace or that David happened to be on the palace roof at the same time she was taking a bath. To say that she's being either careless or calculating sounds very much like the victim-blaming rhetoric that's levelled against victims of sexual harm. Women are expected to change their behaviour, to take certain precautions, to dress and behave in a particular way so that men won't have the opportunity to abuse them.
Yeah, and meanwhile men can just carry on like it's business as usual. Predatory men aren't being asked to change their behaviour so that women can feel safer. Biblical scholars who accuse Bathsheba of enticing David never call out David for looking at her in the first place. Because, let's be honest, he had a choice here. To look at this bathing woman or to look away and give her some privacy. And the fact that he notices she is beautiful suggests he's taking a long, hard look. He's in no rush to avert his eyes.
Yeah, David sounds like a voyeur here, and voyeurism is actually a crime in many countries today.
So how does the law define voyeurism, Em?
Voyeurism is the act of gaining sexual pleasure through watching or recording someone who's doing something privately, like having a bath, getting dressed or undressed, or sunbathing in their garden. The main point is that the voyeur's act of watching is non-consensual. The victim doesn't know they're being watched. They don't consent to it.
And that's exactly what's going on here with David, isn't it?
Mm.
Bathsheba has no knowledge of David's gaze. And no control over it either.
Exactly. So what does David do next, Kaz?
We are told that he, quote, "sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, 'This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite.'"
Okay, so she's married. That should have been a strong signal for David to leave her alone, especially given that adultery was a capital crime in biblical Israel.
Yeah, but that's not what happens, because in verse 4 we read, So David sent messengers to take her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house.
I find it fascinating that everything moves so quickly here. David sees Bathsheba, he asks who she is, he sends for her, and he has sex with her. It suggests to me that he has really poor impulse control and a very strong sense of male entitlement. He likes what he sees and wants it immediately, regardless of the consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And he doesn't seem to want to get to know Bathsheba or even talk to her. There's no dialogue or any sense of a relationship between the two of them. It's very wham-bam. And as you said, David is exercising his entitlement, and he's using his power and privilege to show the world that he can have any woman he wants. Barbara Theod puts it really well when she says that this whole encounter is, and I quote, an exhibitionist display of masculine might and virility on the king's part. By taking Bathsheba, David is exhibiting his superior authority and masculinity. He is accessing another man's woman without that man's consent.
Is there a reason he feels the need to demonstrate his masculine prowess at this particular point in the narrative? I mean, up till now, he seems to be a pretty successful king. He's got lots of wives, he's fathered numerous offspring, he's been successful in battle against Israel's enemies. Do you think he's having some sort of midlife crisis?
Well, the text doesn't tell us explicitly, but Barbara Theod suggests that it might have something to do with the events in the previous chapter, 2 Samuel 10.
What happens there?
Well, Nahash, the king of Ammon, dies, and David sends envoys to visit Nahash's son, Hanun, so they can pass on his condolences. But King Hanun is convinced by his advisors that the envoys are actually spies sent by David to scope out the city. So Hanun decides to publicly shame David's messengers. He shaves off half of each man's beard and cuts off their garments at the waist so that their buttocks will be exposed. Both of these actions undermine the envoy's masculine honour. And because they're David's men, Hanun is effectively shaming and emasculating David too.
And does David take revenge against the Ammonites?
Yes, he does. At the start of chapter 11, we're told that David's army is out ravaging the Ammonites, although he's chosen to stay at home, hence why he's on the palace roof, ogling Bathsheba.
Okay, so David's masculinity has taken a beating from King Hanun, and it's possible he uses Bathsheba to remedy that?
Yeah, that's right. By taking the wife of another man, he's demonstrating that he still has masculine power and privilege. He's not lost control. He's still in a position of authority. Bathsheba's body effectively becomes a tool that he uses to show he's still an, air quotes, real man.
Ugh, it's so toxic.
Yeah.
He's grandstanding, isn't he? Trying to prove that his masculinity hasn't been undermined. It reminds me of Andrew Tate, that infamous misogynist and self-proclaimed influencer. He posted a video of himself online where he's sitting in this throne-like chair dressed in a red and gold boxer's robe with a huge cigar in his hand, and all because Greta Thunberg teased him on Twitter by alluding to his, air quotes, small dick energy. He couldn't bear to have this hugely influential young woman question his masculinity. He had to show the world that he was every inch the man he claimed to be.
Yes, I remember that. It was so, so bizarre.
Yeah. But getting back to David and his own desire to bolster his masculine credentials, I wonder if that explains why he didn't seem to make any effort to keep his meeting with Bathsheba a secret. You'd think he'd want to hide the fact that he's about to commit adultery, but he doesn't, does he?
No, he doesn't. By the time she comes to the palace, there must have been quite a few people aware of what he's doing, including David's servants and messengers and all the servants in Bathsheba's household too. So yeah, it could have been his way of telling the world that he's not lost his touch. His masculinity is still intact. And it also speaks to his sense of entitlement, doesn't it? As the king, as God's anointed, he's probably used to doing exactly what he wants to do, and no one dares stop him. And let's be honest, he's certainly not the only man to use his royal entitlement to prey on vulnerable women, is he?
He's certainly not. Now, there's a big question hanging over this story, isn't there?
Okay, what question is that?
Well, what happened between David and Bathsheba? Was it a consensual affair, or did David rape her? This question is always cropping up in biblical scholarship, and it's never been fully resolved.
Yeah, well, for some scholars, there's nothing in the text to suggest that David raped Bathsheba. Verse 3 simply says, she came to him and he had sex with her. So they read it as a consensual affair, arguing that she came willingly enough to his palace and she must have known why David wanted to see her. So, if she didn't want to have sex with the king, she only needed to refuse his invitation. According to one scholar I came across, Bathsheba was, and I quote, a willing and equal partner.
Yeah, but there's nothing in the narrative to suggest that Bathsheba was willing, and she certainly wasn't an equal of David, was she?
Can you say a bit more about that, Em?
Sure. So David was the king, the Lord's anointed, and she was a woman married to one of David's soldiers. Could she refuse a summons from the king? Could she turn down his request or demand for sex? Readings that assume Bathsheba consented because she came to the palace totally ignore the huge power imbalance between her and King David.
Yes, that's so true. And they also ignore the language used in this verse. The Hebrew literally says, David sent messengers to take her. Now, the Hebrew word translated as take here can sometimes convey aggression, such as seizing, grabbing, or capturing something or someone. It's the same verb used in Genesis chapter 34, verse 2, to describe Shechem's rape of Jacob's daughter Dinah. So here in 2 Samuel 11, it might suggest that Bathsheba is physically seized or manhandled by the messengers. Or it could at least imply that coercion was used to bring her to the palace. Perhaps they tell her she has to go with them, or maybe she felt compelled to accept the summons from the king. I read a really good quote from womanist biblical scholar Wilda Gaffney recently, and she makes this point so well, and let me read it out to you. She says, Bathsheba's going with David's soldiers on her own two feet should in no way be read as consent, but rather as a holding on to a shred of dignity by not being dragged or carried out.
David using messengers to collect Bathsheba actually reminds me of some more recent cases where powerful men used their own messengers to gain access to women and girls.
Oh, can you give us some examples?
Sure. I'm thinking of men like Jeffrey Epstein, whose friend Ghislaine Maxwell would routinely arrange for girls to come to Epstein's house where he would sexually assault them. Or Peter Nygaard, who had staff members specifically tasked with finding girls to come to his house, where some of them would be drugged and then raped by Nygaard. And of course, there's Harvey Weinstein, who would sometimes get one of his female staffers to invite young actresses back to his hotel room on the basis that he wanted to discuss potential movie roles. But once they were there, the female staffer would leave and Weinstein would sexually harass or assault the woman.
For powerful men like Epstein, Weinstein and Nygaard, the rules don't seem to apply, do they? They're privileged. They can carry out their abusive behaviour in plain sight. They have power. Who can say no to them? And they're entitled. They believe that they deserve to get what they want. And these men, and men like them, are very good at projecting their power, privilege and entitlement, so that the young women they victimise often feel incapable of walking away. They don't believe they have a choice because they're effectively being coerced due to their own lack of power and privilege. But what infuriates me is that despite this, victims of these powerful men are often still blamed for their assaults. And Bathsheba gets blamed too. I've heard biblical scholars state that she has only herself to blame because she went to the palace. What did she expect would happen?
Ugh, it's so infuriating. And victims today still get asked that same question, don't they?
Yeah.
What did you expect when he offered you a lift or invited you to his hotel room or round to his house? Women are all too often named, blamed and shamed by the press and on social media after they've accused a powerful man of sexually harming them. They're branded as liars, sluts, attention seekers and gold diggers, even when the man they've accused is found guilty in the court of law. This desire to blame rape victims is so ingrained in our cultural consciousness that it's almost become the baseline response to allegations of sexual assault.
Yeah, that's so true.
have another question for you, Kaz, about the statement in verse 4 that Bathsheba was, quote, purifying herself from her uncleanness. Some scholars suggest that this refers to the bath she had earlier when David first saw her. And a lot of translations add that she is, quote, purifying herself after her period. But I've also read other interpretations that suggest that this is a second bath she has at David's palace after he's had sex with her or raped her. So which of these two options do you think is most likely?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I did check a commentary by biblical scholar Graham Auld, who, by the way, was one of my old Hebrew teachers.
Nice.
Yeah, he's great. And he points out that the Hebrew words in this phrase aren't typically used to refer to menstruation. The Hebrew word translated as purifying herself comes from the Hebrew root kadash, which refers to holiness. The term, as it's used here, may suggest that Bathsheba is either making herself holy or showing herself to be in a holy state. The same term is used in Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 23, where God promises to show his holiness to the nations. So Graham Auld suggests that Bathsheba may be demonstrating something about herself here. Perhaps she's wanting to show her innocence and lack of culpability, either to David or to God or to herself or maybe even to the readers. So we could translate this verse as follows. So David sent messengers and he took her, and she came to him, and he had sex with her while she was declaring herself holy. Then she returned to her house.
That's really fascinating. If Bathsheba is declaring herself holy while David is raping her, then that could be understood as Bathsheba's attempt to declare her innocence and her lack of consent. Perhaps it's her way of saying to the readers, don't judge me, it's not my fault, I'm innocent.
Yeah, I agree. But other biblical scholars do prefer to interpret this phrase as a reference to Bathsheba purifying herself by bathing or washing after her rape. Barbara Theod points out that this is a common response by rape victims in the aftermath of their assault. As she says, and I'm quoting, for women who have been raped, the scene is likely a painful one. Bathsheba is doing what women so frequently do first after they have been assaulted, wash their bodies in an attempt to feel clean again after having been violated.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
But whatever Bathsheba is doing here, she goes home afterwards.
So David doesn't want her to stay?
No, it doesn't appear so.
It sounds as though he got what he wanted. He used Bathsheba's body to bolster his sense of masculine power, and now that he's done it, she's basically disposable.
Yeah, that's right. But it's not long before Bathsheba is back in David's life, because in verse 5 we read the following. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant.
The woman? She's not even referred to by name?
No, it's almost as though David and the narrator have forgotten her name already.
Yeah. So did David respond to her message?
The text doesn't tell us that. Certainly he acts on this information, but it's not clear if he corresponds with her at all. But don't you think it's telling that there's no mention of how she's feeling or what she's thinking in this text? Her thoughts and emotions are irrelevant because the story seems to be so focused on David.
Yeah, she must have been feeling absolutely desperate. Her husband's away in battle, so the only way she could have gotten pregnant is through an act of rape or adultery. And if she's accused of adultery when her pregnancy is discovered, then she may well face the death penalty.
Yeah, that's right.
So what does David do next?
He sends a message to his army general Joab, telling him that he wants to see Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite. Now, when Uriah arrives in Jerusalem, David tells him, go down to your house and wash your feet.
Okay, that's a little bit random. What does David mean here?
Well, I mean, he could literally be telling Uriah to go and have a relaxing foot bath. I mean, his feet are probably pretty tired and dusty after all his time on the battleground.
Sure, I guess.
But some scholars do point out that the Hebrew word for feet, raglayim, is also used euphemistically to refer to genitals. So when David tells Uriah to go home and, air quotes, wash his feet, he may be telling him to go and have sex with his wife.
Ah, so it's a little bit of locker room banter.
Yeah.
And I presume David wants Uriah to have sex with his wife because that will offer a legitimate reason for her pregnancy?
Yes, exactly.
But Bathsheba doesn't appear to be privy to this plan, does she?
No, she doesn't seem to be. David is still trying to control her body in a really self-serving way.
Does David's plan work, Kaz? Does Uriah go and, air quotes, wash his feet?
No, he does not. We're told in verse 9 that, quote, Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. So after this initial plan fails, David keeps trying to persuade Uriah to spend time with Bathsheba. After a couple of other failed attempts, David even plies Uriah with alcohol in the hope that he'll go home and have drunken sex with his wife. But nothing works. Uriah insists that he cannot go home while his fellow soldiers remain away in battle.
So it's clear that David has no interest in continuing a relationship with Bathsheba, right? All he wants is for her husband to believe the baby is his.
Yes, I get the feeling David doesn't want anything more to do with her. She's kind of served her purpose.
Do you think there's a chance that Uriah knows Bathsheba's pregnant and the father is David? Could he be winding David up here, deliberately refusing to go home because he's heard about Bathsheba's visit to the palace?
That is such a good question. The text doesn't tell us what's going on in Uriah's head, but it is possible he's heard rumours about his wife visiting David, or even about her pregnancy. So many people must know about it by now. Messengers, servants, neighbours. So if Uriah already knows about the pregnancy, it could explain his stubborn refusal to see his wife or to have sex with her.
So what happens next, Kaz? How does David solve his problem?
He solves things in the most cowardly way possible. He sends Uriah back to the battlefront and asks him to deliver a letter to his army general Joab. Now, in this letter, David tells Joab to, quote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die.
Ah, that is really cowardly behaviour. And the worst thing of all is that he asks Uriah to deliver this letter that effectively signs his own death warrant. That's such a low blow.
Yeah, it really is.
So does this plan work?
Yes, it does. We're told in verses 16 to 17 that Joab essentially does what David asks, and Uriah the Hittite is killed in battle.
Ah, that's so awful. Poor Uriah. And poor Bathsheba. Now she's a pregnant widow.
Well, not for long. In verses 26 to 27, we read, and I'm quoting, when the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. So, effectively, she has to marry the man who raped her and who caused the death of her husband. But how she feels about this isn't even mentioned.
So, when I read 2 Samuel 11, what strikes me is the amount of space taken up by descriptions of David's efforts to deal with Uriah. There are 8 verses dedicated to David's repeated attempts to get Uriah to go home. Then another 12 verses that describe in granular detail Uriah's death and how it was reported to David. Compare that to 1 verse dedicated to Bathsheba's rape and 1 verse about her pregnancy, then 1 verse noting her mourning, her subsequent marriage to David, and the birth of her son.
Yeah, I feel as though Bathsheba was always secondary to this storyline. Despite her being central to the plot, the focus is always on David, his behaviour, his responses. Bathsheba is simply the narrative device that's needed to further the story. And the most important relationship here isn't between David and Bathsheba, it's between David and Uriah.
While there's a woman at the heart of this narrative, it's really all about men, isn't it? Men trying to bolster their masculinity by using women's bodies, men in competition with other men to see who has the greatest power and control, men's sense of entitlement to enact violence and then cover up the consequences with further violence. The whole story seems to offer up an object lesson in the damage that can be done by men who have too much power and privilege.
Yes, that's so true.
So, Kez, does David get his comeuppance?
Yes, he does. Chapter 11 ends with an ominous statement, which reads as follows. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Then, in the following chapter, David is approached by Nathan the prophet, who relates to him a parable about a poor man who has a beloved little ewe lamb, and the lamb was, quote, like a daughter to him. But a rich man who has lots of his own sheep takes the poor man's lamb and cooks it for supper.
Oh no, poor lamb.
I know, it's so such a tragic story. Now, when David hears this parable, he is outraged, and he says to David, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. Then Nathan delivers his famous line to David, you are the man.
Okay, so just to spell it out, I'm guessing Uriah is the poor man and Bathsheba is his little lamb. So David must be the rich man who eats the lamb?
Yes, that's correct.
So it's interesting that the only guilty person is the rich man, right? David. The poor man and his lamb are innocent victims. And that suggests Nathan is casting no blame at all on Bathsheba.
Yes, and it refutes those scholars I mentioned earlier who do blame Bathsheba, to some extent at least, for David's own sins. Nathan then delivers the word of the Lord to David, outlining his crimes and the punishments he'll receive. But the way David's sins are described by Nathan feel to me, at least, a little bit problematic.
Why is that, Kez?
Nathan accuses David of two wrongdoings, having Uriah killed and taking his wife. But there's no mention of David's mistreatment of Bathsheba earlier in the story. It's as though it's simply not a concern.
Yeah, that is problematic. It feels as though David is being punished for the crimes he committed against Uriah, but not against Bathsheba. Meanwhile, Bathsheba is reduced to an object or a possession, a little lamb, who belongs to Uriah and who is taken and consumed by David. And I notice that Nathan always refers to Bathsheba as Uriah's wife, rather than by her name. It's as though she's simply a piece of sexual property that was stolen from its rightful owner.
That's correct, yeah. And that comes up again very clearly when Nathan's outlining the punishments God will inflict upon David. Nathan says that God, quote, will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbour, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight.
But that's so troubling, isn't it? God is going to use women's bodies as a way to punish David. There's nothing mentioned about how these women will feel about this or how much suffering it could cause them, because that's not deemed important in this story. These women are collateral damage in a drama between a powerful man and an even more powerful male-identified deity.
Yes, and Nathan's prediction here does get realised later in 2 Samuel, when 10 of David's wives are raped on the roof of his palace by none other than his own son Absalom.
Yeah, it's such an awful story.
It really, really is. Now, we don't have time to talk about it in this episode, unfortunately, but if any of our listeners are keen to learn more about it, I'll add to our show notes a really good resource that discusses it in more depth.
Is that the Bible study by David Toombs?
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. Now, these 10 wives of King David aren't the only ones who are impacted by his punishments. Bathsheba is too. We're told in verses 15 to 18 that God strikes her newborn son with a serious illness, and after a week, he dies.
So a baby is collateral damage this time, all because God wants to teach David a lesson?
Yeah, effectively. The text goes into great detail about David's fervent prayers and fasting while the child is sick. And then it describes at length his response when he hears about his son's death.
And what does the text say about Bathsheba's response?
Nothing, absolutely nothing. She barely seems to register in this entire chapter. The only other thing we hear about her is in verse 24, where we're told that following the death of their son, quote, David consoled his wife Bathsheba and went to her and had sex with her, and she bore a son, and he named him Solomon.
So in the last 9 months or so, Bathsheba has been the victim of a voyeur, she's been raped and impregnated, she's lost her husband, she's had to marry her rapist, she has to mourn the death of her newborn son, and while she's mourning, her rapist husband impregnates her for a second time.
Yes, that's it, in a nutshell. But all these layers of Bathsheba's victimization are never highlighted explicitly in the text, and they're not always recognized or alluded to by biblical interpreters. At the same time, David continues to be lauded as a hero, the anointed one of God, the Messiah, the forefather of Christ. So his crimes against Bathsheba can often get minimized or forgiven too easily, or they're overshadowed by an excessive focus on his good points, like his heroism during warfare, his skills as a musician, and his successful reign as King of Israel.
This resonates so much with the way that powerful men accused of rape are treated today. Whether they're politicians, world leaders, members of the royal family, or celebrities, they always have plenty of supporters rushing to their aid when accusations against them come to light. And perpetrators or the institutions that support them may even try to silence victims when these accusations are made, or the institutions may turn a blind eye to the abuser's behaviour. That came out so clearly in the case of British celebrity Jimmy Savile. Did you hear about that, Kiz?
Yes, I'm very familiar with the story, but can you tell our listeners a bit more about it?
Sure. So Jimmy Savile was a hugely popular radio and TV celebrity during the 1970s and 1980s, where he hosted a number of primetime shows for the BBC. He was also well known for his charity work. He raised funds for various hospitals and other charities. He rubbed shoulders with the royal family, the Pope, and members of the British government. He was regarded by everyone as a so-called national treasure, and he was knighted by both Queen Elizabeth and the Pope. But in 2012, a year after his death, it was revealed that he had groomed and abused at least 1,000 children and young people over the past 50 years or so. He found his victims in TV studios, in hospitals, schools, even churches, and he committed some of his assaults in these locations as well. Now, there's a strong suspicion that many people who worked with Savile in the BBC and through various charity projects knew about his abuse, but either tolerated it or turned a blind eye to it, either because he intimidated them, or perhaps they were just so dazzled by his celebrity persona that they ignored this problematic behaviour.
It is such a distressing and disturbing case, isn't it? Because for over 50 years, Jimmy Savile was assaulting children and other vulnerable people, and he often did it in plain sight. And yes, he got away with it, partly because he was this very charismatic character, a national treasure, as you said, but also because he was a powerful man. He'd surrounded himself with powerful institutions, the government, the BBC, the health service, the royal family, and the church. And that gave him power and privilege, and it fed his sense of entitlement. And yet, we could say that these institutions effectively protected him, whether or not they realised that's what they were doing.
And we're currently seeing a similar story unfold with British celebrity Russell Brand, aren't we? There seem to be so many resonances with the Jimmy Savile case.
Yeah, there really are. A number of women are coming forward to accuse Brand of sexual assault and other forms of sexual harm, and broadcasting networks such as the BBC are once again under scrutiny for essentially enabling his behaviour. So yeah, very, very similar to Jimmy Savile. Now, getting back to King David, I am in no way comparing him with Jimmy Savile or Russell Brand. Even David doesn't deserve that. But I'm very mindful of the way that David's own wrongdoings and abuses are often hidden or overlooked by biblical scholars, theologians, and religious communities, because they likewise regard David as their own national treasure. Particularly in the Christian church, there's a lot riding on David's reputation because he's held to be a direct ancestor of Christ. And so, David's wrongdoings often get glossed over, or erased, or denied. Bathsheba's rape isn't recognised, or it's reframed as an act of adultery that she's equally at fault for. But I'm sorry, we really need to front up about what's happening in 2 Samuel 11. David rapes a woman and then proceeds to have her husband murdered when she falls pregnant. That's not right. That needs to be called out as massively unethical and hugely abusive.
I completely agree, Kez. Biblical scholars, theologians, and members of biblical faith communities need to recognize that David's legacy comes with a significant amount of baggage. And rather than ignoring that or trying to cover it up, we need to sit with that and think through what it means for our faith. Otherwise, sexual harm and other forms of violence become relegated to something unworthy of our care or concern.
Yeah, that's so true. There's a fabulous quote in Barbara Theed's book where she talks about this process of minimising sexual violence in both the biblical texts and our own communities. So let me read it out to you. Our present-day rage means nothing if it allows free passes. Sexual assault anywhere and everywhere, in any media, in any art or literature, in any society, must be named for what it is. Otherwise, we are compromised before we speak at all. Worse, we collude with ancient texts by excusing and rationalising their violent content.
Amen.
So, before we go, shall we share with our listeners what we've been reading or viewing this week?
Sure. So I've been listening to a podcast homegrown here in Aotearoa called The Commune. It's a 12-part documentary podcast about the notorious free love commune, Centrepoint. Lots of the themes we've talked about today around power, masculinity, and sex apply to the leader of Centrepoint, Bert Potter. It's an absolutely wild story. It's not an easy listen at all, but it's an important story to hear, and I think audiences both within New Zealand and further afield will find it really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. I will definitely give that a listen. Now, I've been listening to a podcast called Faith on Trial, Hillsong, produced and narrated by journalist Stephen Drill. It's about the rise and fall of the megachurch Hillsong, and each episode deep dives into the various abuses of power perpetrated by Hillsong's founder, Brian Houston, and his father, Frank, as well as other leaders and pastors in the church. It's so fascinating, and it captures perfectly some of the themes we've been talking about today with regard to the dangerous potential of male power, privilege, and entitlement. So I would highly recommend it to you and to our listeners to have a listen.
Oh, yes. I've actually listened to that recently as well and will absolutely endorse your recommendation. So thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Bloody Bible. As always, the resources we used are listed in our show notes, which you'll find on our website, along with the links to our social media accounts.
But until next time, we'll sign off and say goodbye. Stay safe, everyone.
Bye.
The Bloody Bible podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. Special thanks to Professor Johanna Stiebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us to create the podcast and supported us into the second series. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and me, Richard Bonifant, who also recorded and edited each episode whilst apologising profusely on behalf of all men. Our music is Stalker by Alexis Ortiz-Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. You can find our social media links and links to various support agencies in the podcast notes.